Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin.
And I'm Sarah.
And we are face-to-face.
Oh my gosh. We've had like a weird run where you were gone, were traveling, and then we were like gone from Hellbent for like a week.
Yeah.
And then we were back for like one episode, and then I was like, see ya, bitch.
You're right.
And then you were like going to Comic-Con.
I know.
And so the month of July.
I know.
Like, we haven't seen each other as much as we want to. And I will say that I love doing these podcasts together,
in person.
It's way better.
It's so much better. It's more fun.
Yeah.
The end product is better.
Yeah. We were doing a Skype while I was still in the Bay Area for Monday's episode. And it was so hard because both of our Skypes were lagging.
Yeah.
So we couldn't tell when, like what was real time.
Right.
So we kept kind of, like, interrupting each other by accident. Like, it was hard.
It was really hard.
It took a lot of mental energy.
It did. And there were definitely parts where we started the same section at the same time.
Yeah.
So we literally sound like we're, like, doing it in tandem.
Yeah.
Which I guess is weird. Yeah. But, like, I was like, okay, fine. Yeah. We'll just do it together.
It just makes me laugh, though, that we started the podcast like thinking that that was preferable.
Right.
We're like, the traffic is just too crazy, too like wild
right.
in LA. This is better. I'm like, no, it's way better to do it in person. Also, my mother's internet speed. Oh, that was a whole drama. The reason why it took longer than usual to get the episode up is because like her upload speed was like 0.67 like Mbps or whatever. And we finally, like, it was gonna take 5 hours for me to upload on our Google Drive for Devin to edit, and I was like, it might be faster for me to take a flight back to LA
I was like
hand it to her.
Put it on a USB drive, put that USB drive in an envelope.
Yeah.
Address that envelope to me and send it to me, and let's see what gets there first.
Messenger service. Finally, my mom's neighbor came through.
Real MVP.
It was the real MVP. So after a couple of hours, we were able to upload it. So it was a whole thing. Anyway, the TLDR is, it's way better to be in person.
I'm
so glad we're back.
I know.
We have a packed show today, as always.
I mean,
I've just accepted that our Thursday show / our Monday show now too. It's just gonna be long.
I mean, we were talking about it last night as we were doing it, like finishing up the outline, and I was like, yeah, so our outline's like 10 pages. It's fine. Plus an interview. That doesn't include the interview.
That doesn't even include the interview.
Yeah.
Sometimes I get stressed about that. But I'm learning to accept the things I cannot change.
Yeah, exactly.
And in this administration, there's too much.
Like a tight 2 hours.
A tight 2 hours. We're gonna try to do an hour. I don't think it'll be 2 hours.
No.
But let's go through what we're gonna discuss today. So of course we always start off with listener feedback and updates on our end. Block two, return of the perma block, Trump land bullshit. We're going to be talking about healthcare again. And then the trans-military ban that just happened yesterday. There's lots of issues around that we're going to delve into.
Yeah.
As always, things are fucking confusing because Donald Trump is our motherfucking president, apparently. We're also going to talk a little bit about the Boy Scout rally at the top, but we're not going to go into it too much.
No, but I do think it's important to talk about.
To discuss.
It really speaks to, we'll get into it,
We'll get into it.
Yeah.
Block three is our interview.
Yes.
And we are so excited about our interview today. We're going to be talking to Georgia gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams.
Stacey Abrams.
She is one to look out for.
Yep.
She is incredible. We've talked about her on the podcast before.
Yeah.
Dynamic woman. Definitely rising star in the Democratic Party. So we're really excited to get to talk to her. Then after that, we have our gratitude check. And then because it is Thursday, we have our Maxine Waters update and the Maxine Waters Award in Badassery. And we haven't done that in a while because we skipped last Thursday.
Right, that's right. And we have a bunch of recipients, which I always love.
I love.
There's always tons and tons of dickwads.
Yeah.
But we've got a bunch of...
We like when we have a lot of...
Honorees.
And then finally, we have our action items. So stuff you can do after you listen to the show. Okay, Devin, let's get into some listener feedback and general Hellbent updates. So what's the first bit of feedback that we want to share?
Well, a listener at What Is Liz on Twitter tweeted at us, quote, I want the Democratic slogan to be, it's fuck this shit o'clock. And I hard agree.
I think that would be better than what they came up with.
I mean, yeah. So, and she's referring to the one that Chuck Schumer just unveiled, which is a better deal. Which, I mean, let's take a hot second to talk about how Hillary's campaign launch speech in June 2015 included this, like, a better deal.
She literally said, Americans want a better deal. Right. Or Americans need a better deal. She literally had it in her campaign launch speech. Like,
right.
I feel like this is just such a dude thing to fucking do.
Oh, it
do.
Is.
Like, ignore a woman's ideas, steal them.
Right.
And then blame the woman for not thinking of it in the first place.
Right, right, right. Like, and then, like, repackage it as, like, look at this great thing I came up with.
I'm like, that was fucking Hillary's whole fucking platform.
Like, a better deal for...
Did anyone ever read HillaryClinton.com/issues? Like, it's all there.
I did. And then, you know, speaking of noted dickwad, for the moment, yeah. I don't want to give him that moniker forever,
yeah.
But noted dickwad Schumer... at Midwestern Maelstrom.
Midwest Maelstrom.
Midwest, not Midwestern.
Yes, Midwest.
Maelstrom tweeted, said, quote, thank you for calling out Schumer's bullshit. I thought I was alone in my rage bubble.
Oh, no, you were not.
Nope.
We can assure you.
Oh, we were pissed.
We had some feelings.
Yes, we did. And even via laggy Skype.
Oh, yeah.
We had some
laggy
feelings.
Laggy Skype cannot stop our feelings on that,
no.
On that bullshit.
And then Katie also agreed and said, quote, this Chuck Schumer, Hillary Clinton rant on hell bent is so cathartic. Thank you. Chicken soup for my angry feminist soul, which is the name of my memoir.
Yes. If it's not already a book title already.
Right.
We're trademarking that. Or Devin is, at least. And then Lexi, speaking of podcast length, you know, we've sort of...
Tight 2 hours.
We've sort of had, like, mini therapy sessions about how stressed we are that our podcast gets a little long. She said, read the length. I genuinely enjoy listening to the podcast so much that I don't even realize how long they are. That being said, when you announced you were going to start doing interviews, I was worried there wouldn't be as much news analysis to make room for the interview content. I've seen other podcasts make content cuts for the interviews, and I generally find the podcast less interesting as a result. So basically, I'm so damn glad that you keep it all in there. The longer, the better, in my opinion. This world is bananas, and hearing you two talk through it all helps me and a lot of other people make a little sense of it all. Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah, that is good
to
hear.
I mean, we definitely do make content cuts because of our interview.
Yeah.
But we try to cover, you know, the top line items still as well.
Exactly. I mean, I feel like our interview portion just replaces our second block.
Yeah, which is usually Russia.
So. Yeah. No, that was great. We got a pronunciation correction because I always pronounce things wrong.
I was there with you.
Yeah.
I really didn't think it was. So this is one of the female Republican senators.
Right. So it's Shelley Moore Capito, not Capito.
Yes.
Like we were saying.
So thank you to Jess for that.
Yes.
Who pointed that out.
And I have another correction. So on Monday, actually, Sarah called me out on this. I said that TrumpCareToolkit.org is by Indivisible Group, but it's not. TrumpCare10.org is.
So many like-minded names.
Exactly. So I just got them confused. So I just, you know, just wanted to, you know, we don't support alternative facts here.
It's true.
Yeah.
And then just one little update on our end. So Patreon contributors, we will have a bonus podcast. We promise one on Monday, but
yes.
Because of the aforementioned technical issues, i.e. my mom's slow internet speed, we weren't able to get around to doing a podcast.
It was just really
triaging
late.
That.
We were triaging a little bit. It was getting late, and I was like...
You're like, I gotta go do a dinner.
Yeah.
I was like, you do that.
Yeah.
Like, you're the MVP for editing this shit. But so we are going to be doing a lot of Russia updates on there, stuff we didn't get to on Monday, then other stories that have come out since then, and then just a smattering of other Trump land bullshit that's flying below the radar.
There's always so much.
So we will have that for you before the weekend.
Yes.
Okay, Devin, let's get into some Trumpland bullshit.
Return of the permablock! Sorry.
That really took me by surprise.
I know.
That was funny.
That's why I do it.
It's so much better being in person. I love it. But before we talk about healthcare and the trans military ban, let's address that bananas Boy Scout rally that happened on Monday, but feels like 4,000 years ago.
Right, right. Well, so this was Monday. We're not going to spend too much time on this because, I mean, it's really nothing surprising.
You're
like,
right.
This is kind of what
this
Trump does.
Par for the course.
Yeah, I mean, this is who he's always been. Day one of his campaign, he called Mexicans rapists.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is not like...
The people who are surprised by this, I want to be like, where the fuck were you
during
the campaign?
Yeah.
Literally, he showed us who he was.
Right.
I believed him.
Yeah. Right?
I took it at face value.
Right. It wasn't some,
you're
like...
You're a bigoted asshole.
Exactly. This is not some, like, huge, like, extended art piece that he's doing here.
God.
So, Daniel Dale from the Toronto Star did a really good roundup of the 17 most absurd things from this, like, speech he gave. And we'll link to it, and it is...
In our show notes.
It is bananas.
Yeah.
So here are some lowlights. He told a 5-minute story about a formerly rich friend and, quote, the hottest people in New York.
To a crowd of Boy Scouts.
Boy Scouts, which would range, what, like probably 10 to 18 was probably the age range. I don't know that for a fact, but that's
They're young, is the point.
They're young.
Like, this is not relevant to the youth.
He bragged about his election victory because, you know, 6 months, actually more than that because it was in November.
Yeah.
This is what we're still talking about. But it really, it's Hillary who can't stop talking
about it. Why won't Hillary stop talking about the election? I always tweet that when there's a new Trump thing because I'm like, you motherfucker, she gives one quote and you, like, pounce all over her. And this dickwad was passing out electoral college maps.
He framed it and hung it up in the White House.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Okay. So, and he also bashed Obama, but the crowd booed.
Ugh.
But he also told the crowd that he's going to kill Obamacare. And the Boy Scouts responded with chants of USA. Okay.
Ugh.
So here's the thing.
Jesus.
These are young kids who really don't understand. I mean, I would guess. Some of them probably do, but I'd say the vast majority of them do not understand what it means to kill Obamacare.
Right.
But I will say that it's just, it really shows how impressionable young kids are. And, you know, did you know that I'm a mom?
Well, I was just going to say, before you get into your mom perspective, which I think is valuable here, you know, I remember reading some sort of think piece on it. Like, kids have a great bullshit meter, but like you said, they're also impressionable.
Right.
So it's kind of in tandem.
Yes.
Like, they're not as beholden to, like, power dynamics.
Right.
Like, they're like, I don't give a fuck if you're president of the United States. Like,
right.
I'm going to say, like, your shoe's untied.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
But then they also are, like you said, are very impressionable.
Yeah.
And saying stuff like this can leave... I mean, it kind of haunts me that this is the president a lot of kids are going
to
grow up with.
Right. So that's kind of what I was going to say. Like, it's very difficult to see this sort of thing. And it being... It's, like, kind of a footnote. We have a ton to talk about, and I understand why it is. But the president isn't just the leader of our political system. In a lot of ways, this office is the leader of the country and people
of generations.
Of generations. I mean, men stopped wearing hats after JFK because he didn't wear one.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So hats were very much in fashion until JFK because he didn't wear one.
Oh.
And so
that's not something I knew.
Yeah. And so everyone stopped wearing hats. So it's kind of that. And so, you know, the fact that he's speaking to Boy Scouts, which is a very, you know, like, they're kids. They Boy Scouts teaches, like, teamwork and this sort of, like...
They're supposedly supposed to teach all these, like, core values.
Right.
Like, here you have this dickwad.
Right.
You know, saying all this bullshit.
Yeah. And it's really disgusting. And, you know, it's a big part of what... For many other reasons, but, I mean, I don't want my son to be a Boy Scout. I mean...
Yeah, there's other reasons that the Boy Scouts are kind of problematic.
Right, absolutely.
Their core mission speaks to a different
sort of
value system.
Right. But, yeah, and so I'll just say that, and I will say that my only regret in Hank being a boy is that he can't be a Girl Scout, because Girl Scouts are only for female-identifying children.
You're like, the Girl Scouts have more things figured out.
They
I wish I could just put my son in there.
Yes.
Yeah.
So.
But then on Tuesday, Trump held another rally in Ohio, so this was the day after this bananas Boy Scout rally, where he called immigrants, quote, animals who, quote, slice and dice young girls. Again, this is who he is, and it's disgusting.
Yeah.
We've always known this. And, you know, for me, I look at this rally, and I see that this is what happens when the media prioritizes empty podiums during the campaign over policy speeches. And I also just think if people are going to hammer Hillary for not having a, quote, like, strong enough message, then they then have to admit that this kind of blatant hatred is quite compelling to the white Americans who did vote for Trump.
Right,
like,
right.
You cannot watch these rallies and honestly tell me that Trump's appeal is about economics. Like, that's horseshit.
It's really not.
Yeah.
It's really not. But okay, let's talk about motherfucking healthcare.
Yeah, we wanted to address it, but not go into it too much because there is a lot of stuff going on policy-wise that we feel like is important. So healthcare.
Yes.
People are understandably confused about what happened this Tuesday when the Senate convened to start the process of voting on healthcare. So we're going to give a quick gist.
Yeah.
And we're going to admit we are a bit confused
Completely.
Too. I mean, we are following this closely and this process is intentionally confusing.
Right. And it's very difficult to follow. And there's, and, you know, even when you, like, research it and read the write-ups, it's very
convoluted.
Convoluted.
Yeah.
That's a good word.
So on Tuesday, senators voted on a motion to proceed, which is the process by which the chamber can begin formal debate on the bill.
So it's basically voting To vote on it.
Yeah, it's a little meta. No one knew going into it which version of the bill they'd bring, but according to the New York Times, technically it was the House version.
Right. But see, this is another point that, you know, Sarah and I both follow this very closely, and I'm like, wasn't it the House version? And she's like, I thought it was the skinny repeal. And we're like,
what is even happening?
Who knows?
Yeah. And so two Republican women voted no on the motion to proceed, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. That caused a 50-50 tie, which Vice President Mike Pence broke. I feel like he's breaking so many ties. Like, this is setting a record.
It's supposed to be rare.
Yeah, no. And then we'll get into John McCain's bullshit later.
Yes.
Trust us, we have some shit to say about that. And just as a side note, in terms of these two Republican women, as Chris Hayes pointed out, in the last 3 days, Republican men in the House have threatened their female Senate colleagues with a shooting and a beating.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's real. One dickwad challenged Susan Collins to a duel, seriously, or like was sort of quote unquote joking about it.
That's not a funny joke.
Yeah, like he was like, if she were a man, I would challenge her to a duel. Yeah, I can't even unpack that.
Not better.
Like, nope. And then another one said, Ree Murkowski, quote, someone needs to go over there to that Senate and snatch a knot in their ass, which I don't know what that means. I think one of the articles I read said like, it basically means like a beating.
Right, right.
But I also think I kind of want it cross-stitched.
Yeah, and hanging in my
because
house.
Because it's so ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's so disgusting. So like, never tell us again that misogyny has nothing to do with the destruction of women in politics. Because it's happening to Republican women from their own colleagues.
Exactly.
And their own peers.
Yeah. So it's just absolutely disgusting.
Yeah.
But anyway, on Tuesday night, Republicans brought a broader version of the bill to vote on. Since it hadn't been assessed by the CBO, it needed 60 votes to overcome a Democratic objection that it violated Senate rules. And they only got 43 votes. And
this is, I believe, the parliamentarian process that we were referring to last week. That truly, credit where it's due, Bernie Sanders' staff poked holes in that.
And
takes a lot of prep work.
It really does.
So that was crucial.
Right.
And like Devin said, it only got 43 votes.
Right. And then on Wednesday, so yesterday, the Senate voted on just the repeal bill without replacement, which only garnered 45 votes.
Yeah.
So it's...
It seems like a new thing every day.
Exactly.
So like, apparently there's going to be a vote maybe today. We don't know what it is.
Right.
You may have heard the term skinny repeal, which we kind of referenced. Which would eliminate the ACA's penalties for individuals who go without insurance and companies that don't offer it. It would also remove a tax on medical device manufacturers.
Which, why?
A lot of things are confusing. I don't know why.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's a partial repeal from what I understand here.
But it's like not as partial as one may think.
Exactly.
Like the term skinny repeal, I think, is a little misleading.
Oh, it is. Completely. But the CBO score on this quote-unquote skinny repeal is that 16 million Americans would lose insurance and there would be a 20% spike in premiums. So it's not clear that the skinny repeal proposal would even become law, even if it does pass the Senate. More likely, leaders will use it as a vehicle to negotiate with the House and try to find a broader replacement plan that both chambers can agree on. So it's kind of a bargaining tool.
Yeah, but we don't know.
We don't know.
Like, there's so much we don't know, and we don't even know what they're going to vote on today. Like, apparently they're still, like, making tweaks to a bill or writing a bill. Like, no one knows.
They're throwing shit at a wall and seeing what sticks.
That's basically what's happening.
Yeah.
You know? That's sort of the gist of what's going on. Again, we are probably just as confused as you are, so we're trying to summarize it the best we can.
Right.
But let's rewind a little bit and talk about John McCain's role in all this. We promised on Twitter that we'd have plenty of shitty things to say about him.
Oh, yeah.
And we at Hellbent Headquarters keep our promises.
We do. We do. So as we all may know, McCain was recently diagnosed with brain cancer, and that is very sad, and we do wish him the best of luck and good health. But that doesn't stop him from being an asshole.
Yeah, you can be a cancer patient and an asshole.
And a war hero. Like, and that's all fine. Hero. You can do all of that.
Do all those things.
And be an asshole. So he straight up flew to D.C. from Arizona just for this vote on Tuesday, voted yes on the motion to proceed, and had the gall to rip Republicans on subverting the process. Which, if you're really pissed about it, don't vote for it.
Yeah, like, why would you vote yes?
Yeah.
He even told Lisa Murkowski she did the right thing. But why didn't you do the right thing?
Exactly. I mean, a no vote from McCain would have been decisive and probably would have forced his party to kind of use these more normal procedures, like bipartisanship and committee hearings.
What are those?
I don't even know anymore.
I don't even know.
Yeah. And this is kind of, this is what drives me bananas yes. about McCain, is that he's this, like, he's got this mavericky, like,
label
brand. And exactly. And he says these mavericky things, but then he does the exact opposite.
Yeah.
And in fact, he's voted over 90% of the time in line with Trump's position. So maverick, my right butt cheek.
Yeah. Maverick, my ass.
Yeah,
I think that's our episode title.
Yes.
I do, on that vein, I do really like what Deadspin's Alex Perrine had to say about him, I believe in February. Quote, McCain will once again try to paint himself as a courageous truth teller while not actually doing anything.
Yeah.
And that pretty neatly sums
that's
him up.
Very true. So, sort of on a related note, how did you feel, Sarah, about Democrats applauding McCain on the Senate floor before the vote happened? It really seemed to rile a lot of people up on Twitter.
Yeah, I noticed that. For me, it more annoyed me than angered me,
yeah.
although I did understand people's anger.
Yeah.
And we posed the question in our Facebook group, and I like what one of our listeners, Shannon, had to say. She said, quote, "Them lending him support as friends and colleagues doesn't bother me. Them choosing to do it in the context of the floor vote that he rushed back for so that he could take health care away from millions, yeah, that bothers me."
Yeah.
And that kind of, that sort of speaks to how I feel. And, you know, former Hillary Clinton campaign staffer Christina Reynolds also made a really good point. Senator Hirono cast her vote after a second surgery battling stage 4 cancer. I think that deserves a standing ovation. And that's a female senator from Hawaii.
Right. Who, yes. So, well, I agree. Senator Hirono does deserve a standing ovation. You know, and Senator McCain is doing something that is wrong on so many levels.
Yeah.
And I understand that and I agree with that. However, he is a longtime colleague and friend of many of the people working in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
He's been a public servant since 1987, and he is unlikely to be serving much longer. And this might be the last time many people see McCain in person.
Right.
So while this particular context doesn't feel good, it's probably the only context many will have to wish him well.
Yeah.
It's,
you don't think they should have, like, sort of done it privately?
I mean, privately would have been better.
Yeah.
But I also understand what they were doing.
Sure.
You know, it's a tough time for him and his family, and hugging him and wishing him luck, I think, is totally appropriate.
Right.
I mean, that doesn't make what he's doing right, but basic human kindness is kind of what the Democrats pride themselves on. And I really think that I understand the anger and the irritation.
Yeah.
But I'm also at some point.
It doesn't get at you that as much.
Mm-mm.
See, and this is what we talked about in our last podcast. It's okay for feminists to disagree.
Absolutely.
Devin and I don't quite see eye to eye, but I can understand your perspective.
Right.
And, yeah, I was also annoyed that people seem to be going after Cory Booker for hugging him when Bernie Sanders did the same thing.
Right.
For me, that speaks to a larger bias.
Right. Exactly. Like, if you're going to go after all the Dems, fine.
Yeah.
But if you're going to single people out, go fuck
Especially
yourself.
Especially when Bernie did a similar thing.
Right, right.
Okay, so let's move on to Trump's snap decision to ban transgender people in the military, which happened fucking yesterday.
I feel like it came out of left field.
It did. This particular decision did, but the Trump administration sort of rolling back LGBT civil rights
100%
feels in line with a pattern.
It totally
is. Yeah, this particular thing was like, what? Why the fuck?
like this is the moment? Really?
Yeah, so he announced on Wednesday, which is yesterday, we're recording on Thursday, that he plans to reinstate a ban on transgender individuals from serving, quote, in any capacity in the U.S. Armed Forces. And of course, he announced it on Twitter.
Like, don't use Twitter as the leader of the free world. Put it away.
That's never going to happen with him.
I know.
So this decision reversed a policy that was initially approved by the Defense Department under President Obama, which was still under final review, that would allow transgender individuals to openly serve in the military. But then Defense Secretary James Mattis announced last month that he was delaying enactment of the plan.
So this is
kind of in limbo.
Right. So this is sort of the pattern and the rolling back that, you know, you referenced,
yeah.
where obviously this decision, this tweet comes out of left field, but the whole process does not.
Yeah.
So the actual tweet said, quote, "Our military must be focused on decisive and overwhelming victory and cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical costs and disruption that transgender in the military would entail," which, first of all,
it's bullshit.
And it's also a very incomprehensible tweet. Like, he's not saying anything, and grammar, whatever.
Well, if, like, we want to look at that argument.
Yeah.
I mean, that's bullshit, because according to the Boston Globe, which was via Rand numbers, the military spends 5 times as much on Viagra.
Right.
As it would on transgender medical care. So that's fucking bullshit.
Right. Well, and also, according to Politico, Trump didn't do this because of the tremendous medical costs, but because it was a concession for money for his border wall.
Yeah, so apparently there's been some sort of behind-the-scenes wheeling and dealing.
Right.
And from what I understand, he was going to make this decision eventually, but he sort of accelerated announcing it because there were Republicans who were withholding money for his border wall unless he made this concession.
Which is disgusting, too.
On multiple levels.
Multiple levels. And of course, Trump's decision came without a plan in place to implement it. So Sarah Huckabee Sanders could not really articulate how and when this would happen. But, you know, that really means that as many as 10,000 openly serving troops are facing a discharge from the military and thus immediate unemployment with no information.
No sense of how it's going to happen,
right.
What's going to happen to them. Although this morning, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs told the U.S. Military that, quote, no modifications to current transgender policy is going to happen until implementation guidance is given. So basically what they're saying is, Trump can tweet a bunch of shit, but no official guidance has been issued.
Right.
Therefore, nothing is happening yet, which is just such a nutshell, like Trump's presidency in a nutshell.
Absolutely. And then even motherfucking Orrin Hatch put out a statement condemning this move. He said, quote, "I don't think we should be discriminating against anyone. Transgender people are people and deserve the best we can do for them," which is not what I expected Orrin Hatch to say.
We are living in such a dark time.
Right.
That even Orrin Hatch is coming
like,
out and
like,
defending the transgender community.
Yeah.
Like, we are the upside down.
Yeah.
Like, this is how dark of a presidency this is.
The darkest timeline of Lost.
The darkest timeline. But we really want to read this thread from Sandra Mitchell about what this move means for the people that it's going to affect. So Sandra Mitchell said, quote, "I'm queer and I served under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. If you got caught, if someone reported you, you didn't get a court date. You got a separation date. They gave you a general discharge instead of an honorable one, usually on a Section 8, quote, mentally unfit for service. This meant you never qualified for veteran benefits of any kind. No VA service, no grants or scholarships as a veteran, no veteran housing assistance, nothing. And it was on your transcripts forever. General discharge, mentally unfit for service. Imagine what that does when you have to apply for civilian employment. So you joined the military because you were patriotic or because you wanted to learn a career or you were poor and wanted to get the GI Bill or because you truly genuinely believed that you were working in service to the American people and to the ideals of creating a more perfect union. But if you were queer, they sectioned you out and stained you for life. I cried at Pride a few years ago when I saw those out and proud service people marching in the parade. We had come so far. They had come so far. And it healed in me the hurt I held in my heart from being sectioned out under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Today's pronouncement from Trump cuts a new wound deeper because it sets us back. We aren't moving forward. We're moving back to shame and censure and erasure from public life and public service."
Yeah. And as friend of the pod, Caitlin Burns, wrote in Go Magazine, "It's not just about trans people in the military. This feels much bigger than one military policy. It feels like we're being cut out from the fabric of our own nation."
That, I think she puts it beautifully. That's exactly what it is. I think you can have complicated feelings about the military as an institution itself.
That's fine.
But really what this is about is a rolling back of civil rights.
Right, right. And then also on Wednesday, Department of Justice lawyers said in federal court that a 1964 civil rights law, Title VII...
Yeah, of the Civil Rights Act.
Of the Civil Rights Act, does not protect a gay employee from discrimination. So this Trump administration's attack on LGBT rights is not an isolated incident, nor is it new, as we referenced earlier.
Yeah.
So, like, while this feels very sudden,
yeah,
this is part of a larger pattern,
yeah,
of the Trump administration taking away LGBT rights.
Yeah. I think for me, I also want to talk about how this intersects with the Democratic leadership's messaging plan moving forward, because Politico wrote a piece a few days ago called, quote, "Democrats sidestep social issues in new economic push." And Chuck Schumer is quoted as saying, quote, "The focus starts on economic issues. That's where the American people are hurting." And then he also acknowledges that this new agenda, quote, "purposely avoids the social issues such as immigration, reproductive justice, and yes, LGBT rights."
Yeah, I can't. I cannot with this.
Yeah, we have some fucking rants about
some fucking feelings. You know, social issues very heavily intersect with economic issues. We've said this before. We will say it again. You know, economic rights are...
There is no economic justice without social justice.
Exactly. Exactly.
And, you know, that Sondra Mitchell thread we just read just explained how Don't Ask, Don't Tell ruined LGBT people's job prospects and public program benefits. And then as NPR's Sam Sanders noted the other day, trans people enlist in military service at about twice the rate of the general population, with the U.S. military being the biggest employer of American trans people. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. So to repeat, social issues are economic issues. And like, Devin, I feel like besides, we shouldn't have to put a fucking dollar amount next to marginalized groups to convince people that they should give a fuck about them.
Oh, seriously. I mean, I understand like Chuck Schumer's logic here, you know, but really what he's trying to do is become like Republicans light.
Yeah.
You know, and saying, oh, we have to,
only can focus on economic issues because people don't have strong feelings about that.
Right.
That's how we're going to, you know, win moving forward. But for me, it's absolutely unacceptable.
Oh, 100%.
For Democrats to shy away from these issues in order to try to win back these like
white working class voters.
A, it blatantly ignores, like we've talked about, fundamental truths about how, quote, identity politics, which is really just civil rights, impacts people's economic opportunities.
Right.
And B, it's not going to fucking work. Like, well, you said, it's like, how are we going to win by being GOP light?
Right. And also, it completely ignores the actual Democratic base.
Yes.
Which is Black women.
Yeah.
I mean, not just Black women, but
Black women are the base.
Are the base.
For sure. But just, you know, the base as a whole cares about these civil rights
exactly.
issues.
Exactly.
I care about LGBT issues. I care about trans people.
Absolutely.
Like, this is unacceptable to me. And
I also care about economic issues. I also care about healthcare and Russia.
But you put the two together.
Exactly.
And all these white dudes are pushing for Democrats to only focus like in a tunnel,
vacuum.
In a vacuum on economic. And I don't understand how that moves the party left either.
It doesn't.
If you're ignoring civil rights issues, I don't understand how that makes us more progressive.
It doesn't.
That doesn't make us more progressive in my mind.
No.
So we wanted to talk about in this context because I think it's important for people who care about these issues to push back on Democrats, because this is the kind of shit that's happening every day in the Trump administration.
Right.
And so we have to put up a two-pronged fight here.
Yeah.
We have to fight against the Republicans who are doing this shit, and then we have to fight against the Democrats who don't want to focus on this shit as much.
Exactly. And as Democrats, we need to double the fuck down. We don't do this by becoming GOP light. We do this by sticking to our ideals and becoming the Democrats that we all want to be.
Yeah. All right, Devin. So we're excited to talk to our next guest. Stacey Abrams was just until recently the House Minority Leader for the Georgia General Assembly and is currently a state representative for the 89th House District. She is the first female leader of either party in the Georgia General Assembly and is the first African-American leader in the Georgia House. In 2014, Emily's List recognized Abrams as the inaugural recipient of the Gabrielle Giffords Rising Star Award, among many other honors she has received. In June, Abrams announced her intent to run for Georgia governor in 2018, setting her up to potentially be the nation's first Black woman governor ever. We're thrilled to get to speak with her on the podcast today. Welcome, Representative Abrams.
Hello, hello.
Hi.
You've had quite the day already. You said you were at the airport at 7 a.m. You're just like jet setting all over, talking to people.
Heading down to Savannah, meeting with labor union folks. So got to meet with, first meeting was with building trades. If you ever need anything built, these are good people to know.
Nice.
And then did first call or second call actually with longshoremen right before they were going out to head onto their ships. They listened to me talk about running for governor.
Nice. That's so great. The campaign is really, really underway.
Absolutely.
Which kind of brings us to our first question. So no Democrat has won statewide office in Georgia since 2006. So why do you think your campaign has the best shot to flip the governorship blue?
I think it's important to understand the demographics of Georgia. Georgia today, unlike every other southern state, is 53% white, non-Hispanic, 47% people of color. Yet the last five elections that we've run, we have targeted only the white part of our demographic. We've generally ignored people of color. We look at them as turnout targets, but we don't look at them as active, credible voters who need to be engaged just as early. And so I'm running because I know, number one, math works. And that if you take that population and you add it to the very strong white progressive population that you have in Georgia, you cover the 200,000 vote gap that we have seen in the last few election cycles.
Yeah, because I read somewhere that you've each cycle you've cut that gap in half.
Right.
And absolutely. So you're saying the last gap was 200,000 votes?
That's it. Right? That's it. So we lost in 2006 by 400,000 plus votes, lost in 2010 by 257. We lost in 2014 by a little under 200,000.
So wow.
We have enough people here. We just have to talk to them and ask them to vote.
Right.
Yeah, math does work.
Yeah.
I find it very compelling.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do too.
So in June, John Ossoff came within a few percentage points of taking a Georgia congressional seat from a Republican that had won by over 20 points just 7 months prior. So what sort of lessons do you take away from Ossoff's campaign, and what does that swing foretell for your election in 2018?
I know that people were deeply disappointed by John's loss, but I think it's critical for them to understand John did more in that election than we have seen done in a very long time. He closed a gap with Republicans and made them spend extraordinary sums of money to hold a seat that they should have walked into. The best lessons to learn, one, is that field works. He spent a lot of money on the ground. Number two, he had a message that reflected the community he was talking to. But his district looks different than the state of Georgia. He was in one of the most educated districts, one of the wealthiest districts in the state. The state of Georgia does not look like the 6th district. The state of Georgia has more people of color. The state of Georgia has more communities, unmarried women, people who want to have a more granular conversation. And I'm a candidate who has spent my lifetime, not only in politics, but in the nonprofit and for-profit world, understanding the needs and the desires of these communities, in part because of my background. I grew up the daughter of working class parents in Mississippi, sometimes working class, sometimes working poor. My mom liked to call us the genteel poor. We watch PBS. So. But the lessons to learn, that what John did was he understood you had to knock on doors. The challenge was there weren't enough Democrats to overcome the Republicans. There are more Democrats in that district, and with more time, there probably could have been, and with some different choices about investment. But I think John made the best choices to make at the time and in a very truncated election.
Right.
I'm running now for an election that's in November of 2018 because we have to take the time to knock on every door, to talk to voters that we ignore. But most importantly, we have to listen to those voters and find out what matters to them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's interesting, you know, you talk about the demographics and talking to voters about what matters. And, you know, I wonder sort of, you know, it seems like since the presidential election, people have been really hyper-focused on this, like, white working class vote. Right? Like the Obama-Trump voters. And for it drives us bananas. I mean, we've had many rants about
many
it.
Rants.
So many rants.
I've heard a few of them, yes.
Yes. Well, that's what I was going to ask. Like, do you feel like just Democrats nationally are sort of overcorrecting? Are you worried about Democrats overcorrecting? Because your campaign, it seems like it is, you know, going down a path that I actually think is the future. But do you think Democrats nationwide are sort of overcorrecting in terms of this election?
I think we are in this way. We have 50 states. Those states are very different. And the campaign that I need to run in Georgia is not the campaign that Heidi Heitkamp needs to run in North Dakota.
Sure. Right.
We have very different demographics.
Right.
We have very different audiences that we're speaking to. But what we have to remember as Democrats is our core values of economic opportunity, of educational opportunity, of the shared responsibility in our government. That's what makes us Democrats. What makes us successful is talking about those values in terms of the communities we lead. And so for me, I'm talking about educating bold and ambitious children. I'm talking about the fact that we need to actually build a thriving and diverse economy for every county and not just the counties we like.
Right.
And
right.
We need to have government that works. But when you hyper focus on a single community like the white working class, you do it to the exclusion of the other people who also live in your community.
Sure.
And so, yes, I push back very hard because I've watched our elections. We keep losing because we keep trying to convince people who've told us now since 2002 they don't want to be here anymore.
Right.
And it's like you know, chasing someone you dated who broke up with you.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
They're just not that into you.
Yeah.
They're just not that into you. And so let's go find the guy who's been waiting at the coffee shop for us to walk in.
Yes.
I'm ready to do it.
I love that.
We can already see elements of your romance novel. Like,
coming in.
I love the metaphors. If you Hellions, are, this is what we call our listeners. If you don't know, yes. Stacey Abrams, her author name is Selena Montgomery. She's also written romance novels and won awards for the romance novels. Just in case you didn't think she was dynamic enough.
I was going to say, I'm guessing it's because she doesn't sleep. Yeah. That's my theory.
Yeah.
I don't know. So kind of talking about like the white working class and
our values, democratic values.
And Politico reported this week that the Democrats' economic agenda ahead of 2018 under Chuck Schumer, quote, purposefully avoids the social issues such as immigration, abortion, and LGBT rights. What is your response to the National Party, A, not connecting social issues to economic issues, and B, seeming to shy away from the civil rights stances that have defined the Democrats for decades? So, I mean, we were just talking about these sort of core values of being a Democrat,
right.
And it feels like Chuck Schumer's trying to peel us away from that.
Just like Democratic leadership.
Exactly. So kind of what's your response to that?
Social issues are economic issues.
Yes.
We just saw the occupant of the White House decide that because someone is transgender, they can no longer have their job in the military.
Yep.
That is a social issue and that's an economic issue. I'm an African-American woman who wants a job that no Black woman has ever been allowed to have before. And it's not because of my smile. It is because mm-hmm. race has played a part in how we make decisions, and it has played a part in the leadership we choose. My social issue is an economic issue because I would like to have that job.
Yes.
If you cannot get access to the ability to drive if you are an immigrant, then that is an economic issue. And so I think it is very facile and unfortunately a very elitist idea that you can disconnect social issues from economic issues.
Yes.
But at the core, our civil rights legacy has been about being Democrats. The reason we believe in civil rights, the reason we push for human rights, is that we understand that where you begin should not dictate where you end up, and that the government's job is to intervene and intercede and to push out of the way the barriers that keep people from what they need. And the problem we have as Democrats is that we want to be the party of everyone, but we don't want to talk about what everyone needs.
Right, right.
But we have the candidates, and I want to be one of them who's willing to have those conversations. I am not going to shy away from the fact that people of color have to be centered in my campaign.
Yes.
Because I know that I can talk to people of color and white people at the same time, and they're not going to recoil from one another.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They all can listen. And if they believe in my values and I reflect their values, we can win. And Democrats have to stop being afraid of being who we are.
Yes.
Right. I think
you're speaking our language.
Really,
I have to
are.
Say it's really refreshing to hear a prominent Democrat saying that, because it does feel like we've been drowned out with messages that to me have felt overcorrected. And that's a big reason why we wanted to talk to you.
Right.
We feel like your voice is so important.
And shifting our base isn't going to work.
Right.
And I think on that note, Simone Sanders, who was the national press secretary for Bernie Sanders' campaign, said recently, quote, "We need to have a candid conversations about the lack of recruitment and the lack of support for candidates of color on the Democratic side." So from your perspective, how can the party infrastructure better recruit and support candidates from underrepresented groups to push forward this agenda that we can all keep our core values and work together?
I think it begins by acknowledging what we've done wrong. when you only go after candidates who already have everything, then you're not going to find the people who are from underrepresented communities. I've been incredibly privileged. I've managed to navigate a political space where I'm not from the traditional political families. I do not operate the way you're supposed to operate in politics always, but I've been able to build coalitions and develop access. But one thing I've tried to do is to create the same space behind me for others. So I hire teams that look like Georgia. Sometimes it's a little hard because they don't have the same experience, but if you don't give them the opportunity, they're never going to develop that opportunity.
Sure.
Or develop the skills. The same thing is true for candidates. We have to stop recruiting the candidates that look like what we wish we had, and we have to recruit candidates that look like where we are. Because the way you build a bench is by actually going to the people who can win. And if you don't understand the community you're running for, you cannot win them. We keep seeing that again and again. And while someone might look wonderful, you know, in House of Cards as a profile for a candidate, that does not mean that person can win in a small town in Georgia or, you know, win a statewide election in Arkansas.
Yeah.
Right.
I always think of it too. I mean, I've worked in like male dominated industries and certainly industries that are pretty homogenous as well. And, you know, when you're not seeking out talent outside of that, you know, small little like silo, you're missing out on a lot of people who could bring value. And I think that sort of speaks to what you're talking about and what Democrats are missing. It's like there's so many, you know, amazing people that we're missing out on because we're not recruiting enough or something like that.
Right.
Well, it's that, and it's the fact that they will illuminate issues we didn't know existed.
Right.
Right.
There's a moment of privilege when you're elected to office. You cease to have to deal with certain things. You have a tag on your car and you have a key to a building. And sometimes people let you in even if they're not supposed to. And you become used to the level of access that you have. I try very hard to make sure I move my town hall meeting in my community around because I need to be in the wealthiest parts of my community, but I also need to go to the parts of my community that will never, ever expect to see me because I don't know enough to not be there.
Right.
And if we don't recruit candidates from those communities, then we're never going to solve the challenges that those communities face because we don't understand them.
Yeah. Right. That's a really great point.
Yeah. And I really love the idea of picking candidates that can represent the communities. Like you said, you can't run the same campaign in Georgia that you would in North Dakota or California. Right. And I think that's a really important point that has kind of been
lost.
Overlooked.
Yeah, definitely lost. One of our listeners, Janet, so she, we have a Patreon page where people can support our podcast, and she's one of our Patreon contributors. So she wrote and had a question for you. She says, I'm in Georgia and teach on a college campus where campus carry became law on July 1st, even though the Board of Regents, faculty, students, and campus police were heavily against it. What are your thoughts and plans moving forward if elected to address this issue?
So I'm running for governor in part because I watched our governor make the right choice last year and make the wrong choice this year. The difference is that people weren't afraid of an election this time.
Mm.
And there's not an election until 18, and they thought they could get it through this year and not have to pay a price for it. We need to remember, and they need to pay a price, because the only way we're going to rescind campus carry is by changing the governor, but we also have to change the legislature. And anyone who voted to put our children in jeopardy by arming the oldest people on our campuses, and by the way, in Georgia, you do not have to have a day of training to get a concealed carry permit.
Wow.
If you watch, you know, if you pass a background check and watched a really good episode of Gunsmoke, you're pretty upset. That is not the way we should operate as a state, and that's certainly not how we should operate our college campuses. But we have to make people pay a political price. The same way we're pushing the conversation of healthcare, Georgians have to make certain that every time they talk to a legislator, they remind them of their vote on campus carry.
Yeah.
Great.
So what would you say is one of your signature issues? Like, what really motivates you to run and be in politics and put yourself in this space?
I find poverty to be an abomination, but it's also economically inefficient. My parents were deeply poor. We moved up a generation, but we still went back and forth between working class and working poor. I've got five brothers and sisters. Most of us have done well. but I have a younger brother who is a drug addict and is currently serving time in prison in Mississippi. I'm running for governor because I believe that we have to create spaces for everybody. And it sounds so innocuous, but what I mean by that is my parents were able to use education to move our family forward, but not everyone's going to have Robert and Carolyn Abrams as their parents.
Right.
My parents did a great job with five of their six children. And my brother is brilliant, went to Morehouse College, but dropped out because he had an undiagnosed mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
We have to have a government that fully understands that it can't solve every problem, but it needs to create access to solutions for every person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very different way of thinking about it. And so I'm running for office because I couldn't find a way to get people to do what I wanted other than being in charge.
Yes, I love that.
And the governor of Georgia has an amazing capacity to educate our children, to improve our economy, but also to guarantee our rights. And if we do those things well, everybody can succeed. And that is, again, not the sort of pablum of how everyone has an opportunity, but it's true that we create space so that everyone may not have the exact same solution and may not find the same ends, but they should all know that there's a pathway for them, and that's what we can provide.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that.
Me
creating
too.
Space for everyone and setting up a framework where
of
opportunity.
Switching gears a little bit, we did mention this, but you know, as we've noted, you've written and won awards for romance novels that you've penned under a nom de plume, Selena Montgomery. So what compelled you to write romance novels in the first place, and how did you pick Selena Montgomery as your pseudonym?
So I was actually going to write a spy novel based on my ex-boyfriend's dissertation on microzeolites.
That's
a chemical physicist. I'm one of a handful of people who read his dissertation outside of his university. It was really interesting. I thought I would be a physicist at one point in my life, but it turns out I just like watching Star Trek.
Yeah, me too.
We'll have to talk about which one you love the best.
Oh, it's Voyager.
Captain Janeway, the most remarkable captain.
Yes.
Picard is awesome and will always be at the Pantheon, but Janeway had the most complicated leadership responsibilities and is the best captain.
Yes.
That's Kate Mulgrew. I thought I was going to fangirl all over her. She was incredibly kind.
Yes.
And this is when she was doing Orange is the New Black. And I'm
right.
Like, yeah, that's great. But you're Captain Janeway and I love you.
Seriously. Captain Janeway like inspired me as a little girl.
Oh.
And just like her leadership and her confidence and her take no prisoners. It was amazing.
Oh my gosh.
So I just watched it. I just watched the night episode again where she, you know, isolates herself trying to remember and think just that you would never see that vulnerability and that strength in any other captain.
Absolutely not. Everyone's like, Kirk is the best. It's like, okay, yes, Kirk is great. But he's also just such like an archetype, like such a stereotypical like alpha male captain. And I'm like, that's not that interesting to me.
Yeah.
So
none of our listeners can see what's happening, but Devin and Representative Abrams just got like totally nerded out in like the cutest, most animated way. And like, I think this is my favorite moment that we've ever had on our podcast. And Representative Abrams, like Devin is a huge like nerd, comic book nerd and like political junkie. So this is like her sweet spot.
This is.
Well, I was going to mention to both of you that I am from the house of, I'm shocked to find out, but I'm now the house of Slytherin. I one was Gryffindor, but I'm Slytherin
gosh.
Now.
Yeah. That's what I literally said that, except I said I was more like a Griffin puff, like I'm kind of a hybrid.
Yeah.
But I was like, this election turned me into a straight up Slytherin.
Straight up Slytherin.
Like, I am Slytherin as fuck.
Yeah, seriously. So I'm a huge nerd, and I just went to Comic-Con and did a bunch of panels on like gender and comics, and it was amazing because when I can be in cosplay talking about politics and comic books, that's kind of living my best life.
Yeah, living her best life. Yeah.
I can imagine nothing better. So very quickly, wrote a book based on my ex-boyfriend's dissertation, wanted to write a spy novel. Publishers were like, women don't read spy novels and men won't read a spy novel by or about a woman.
What?
Especially one with a woman of color as the lead. If you think about espionage, especially at the end of the 90s, no one did it.
Yeah.
So I made my spies fall in love and wrote it as a romance novel.
Oh.
So I write romantic suspense. And at the same time I published my first novel, I had also published my first tax article on the operational dissonance of the unrelated business income tax exemption.
Oh my gosh.
So you don't sleep. That's cool. That's fine.
This is why, I mean, if I lived in Georgia, I'd be like, Stacey Abrams, you run everything.
Yeah, right?
You like, run all the things.
All of the keys.
Yeah, I'm going to give you all the keys to all the leadership.
That is amazing.
That is amazing.
And yeah, it's kind of true. I mean, I can't really think of a lot of sort of even like sci-fi or thriller or spy novels outside of maybe Octavia Butler.
Yeah, exactly.
But I couldn't bring up another like author who does that.
And it's interesting because one of our first, actually our very first interview of this podcast was with a woman comic book writer.
Yes.
And she was a woman of color. She was an Asian woman. And she was saying the same thing that they're still to this day. I mean, it's hard to break in and to
find that representation.
It's because it's hard as a woman, but it's extra hard if you have an additional layer of, you know, underrepresented groups there. Mm-hmm. So I love that you kind of life hacked that. You're like, all right, I'm going to write a spy novel, but like I'll make them fall in love so I can still kind of write a spy novel.
I still kill all the people I plan to kill.
It's like they love each other. These guys are dead. Yeah. Everyone's happy.
Everyone wins. Everyone wins. So, to close off our podcast, we ask this of every guest we have. So every episode, Devin and I do what we call a gratitude check. So we sort of like to take stock of like the good things that are happening either personally or in the world at large, just because it's such challenging, you know, mentally challenging challenging a lot of times. So we'd love to hear from you. What is something you're grateful for right now? And it could be anything.
Big, small, Netflix.
Can I do three really quick ones?
Yes.
Okay. Monday morning, I was endorsed by the great John Lewis.
Yes. I saw that.
And I say that one not because of his endorsement of me, but the validation that it brings to know that someone who is given so much sees potential in you. That is a remarkable moment for you. Number two, and again, this is because I have a publisher and I don't want them to kill me because your podcast is awesome. Henry Holt just picked up my new book. It's my first nonfiction. It's called Minority Leader, and it'll be coming out in the spring. So
amazing.
Hopefully you guys will invite me back to talk about that.
Yes. Oh, yeah, we'd love to. Devin, especially.
And then number three, I'm so grateful. I have the most amazing brothers and sisters. I love my parents, too, and they're incredible. But I have these five siblings who have very different lives. But the most important thing is they do not take me seriously at all.
Yes.
Like they love me, but they are the most extraordinary way to stay grounded and to remember that I'm still number two and they know what I did when I was seven and they tell someone if I do something wrong.
Right.
Yes.
I have three younger siblings and my baby brother's 10 years younger than I am. And he'll regularly just send me a text with nothing but poop emojis in it. And it's one of those things where it's like, I love them so much. Yeah. So I totally get that.
They keep you honest.
Yeah.
They do.
I don't have a big family, but I do have a twin sister.
Yeah.
So we keep each other quite honest.
Yeah.
We're mirror images. Like, I see you. I see you.
That's great.
Well, I think this is a good note to end off
on. So
thank you to Representative Stacey Abrams for joining us on Hellbent today. You can follow her on Twitter at Stacey Abrams and learn more and support her campaign at StaceyAbrams.com. Anything else we should plug? Maybe a couple of the novels you've already written?
Yeah.
So I would do, two things, because I have a dual personality. One is if you want to read any of the Selena Montgomery novels, they're available on Amazon.com.
Great, yeah.
But the other is, I have now stepped away from it, but started an organization in 2014 called the New Georgia Project.
Yes.
Oh.
We've registered more than 200,000 people of color since then in Georgia, and they're doing extraordinary work. They were part of the Ossoff litigation, the litigation during the Ossoff campaign to help reopen precincts and reopen voting, and they've just been defending rights across the state of Georgia. It's newgeorgiaproject.org. Amazing organization. Find it. Give to it. Love
yes.
it.
I'm going to just go ahead and say it again. I'm pretty sure you don't sleep. I do not understand how you're doing all
of
this.
I was also going to say, no wonder you're feeling so bullish about the math. You're like, I've already registered 200,000 new people. Like,
it's fine. Don't worry about it.
Just on the side, though.
Yeah.
And then I write romance novels. Now I'm running for governor. I do all the things.
It's fine. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us. This was such a fun interview. And I love to meet fellow Trekkies all over the world. We're everywhere.
Sarah and Devin, you're amazing. Aww. I am just honored to be on this podcast. I do listen to Hellbent.
What?
I wasn't joking. I knew about Griffin. I listen to you guys.
No way.
I will tell you, I can't do it all the time because you guys you guys do really dense but yes. really thoughtful interviews. And
oh, thank you.
Sometimes I have to work.
Yes.
But, but I just appreciate what you guys are doing. Oh. You are beating the resistance from the podcast, and you're just making sure that people know what they're resisting and why to fight. So thank you for what you do.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so
much. That means a lot.
It does.
Okay, Devin, let's get into our gratitude checks. And I feel like an adrenaline high after talking to Representative Stacey Abrams.
Oh my
gosh. Was so much fun. I got to see both of you like geek out on Star Trek, which was honestly one of the cutest things I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Like I feel like we're kind of on a high right now.
I am totally on a high.
Cloud nine.
I forgot to tell her when we were geeking out about Janeway, but at Comic-Con, I actually got Nichelle Nichols's autograph.
Who's that?
She played Lieutenant Uhura on the original Star Trek.
Oh,
and she was just the sweetest woman, and it was amazing. So, yeah.
Well, so besides all that, what are you grateful for today?
Okay, well, the first thing I'm grateful for are paid sick day laws.
Yes.
Yes. So the number of Americans with access to paid sick days increased dramatically over the last 2 years as the direct result of new laws mandating the benefit passed mostly by Democratic-controlled state and local governments. Particularly on the West Coast and the Northeast.
Local politics is sexy, guys.
Super sexy.
Or friends. It's sexy friends.
Sexy friends. So the United States is the only developed economy that doesn't require employers to provide workers with paid time off when they're ill.
Of course.
Which makes no fucking sense, but fine. Let's fine. So a little bit of background. 68% of employees in the private sector now get paid sick days. That's close to 79 million people. An increase of 7 points from 2015, according to data released by the Labor Department last week. Last year, 64% of workers had access to paid sick days.
Wow. So that's a 4% increase.
Just in a year.
In a year.
Yeah.
And then 7 points from 2015.
So 2015. That's a good steady increase.
Mm-hmm.
And the increase in access to this paid sick leave was even more dramatic for low-wage workers.
Yeah.
In 2015, just 31% of the lowest quartile of private sector employees had access to these paid sick days. And in 2017, so this year, that number jumped to 43%. So that's a 12% jump, which is huge.
Yeah.
For low-wage workers, missing just a day of work and the pay due to an illness can be devastating.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's so important.
Yeah,
it's
to be able to take care of yourself.
Exactly.
But then if you feel like you have to make a decision between getting paid and being healthy,
right,
then that no one wins there.
Right. It's such a basic thing.
It's a burden.
I mean, and I think Stacey Abrams said it. She was like, not only is poverty a scourge mm-hmm. on our society, but it's also economically inefficient.
Yep.
Because if you're not healthy, you're not doing your best work.
Yep.
So the push for paid sick time began with legislation in San Francisco in 2006.
Woo, go San Francisco.
I know. And Washington, D.C. in 2008. Connecticut, actually, was the first state to enact the law in 2011.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So over the past 3 years, 6 states and 27 municipalities have passed new sick day legislation, including California.
Woo!
Massachusetts.
We both did that at the same time.
Oregon, Pittsburgh, and Chicago. So, I mean, there's a lot of upsides to this. Obviously, like I said, if you're not healthy,
you can't do your best work.
You can't do your best work. The flu rate would actually decline if the U.S. mandated sick leave, like according to this one study. And it also leads to greater employee retention, which reduces training costs.
Right.
Just to make this economically, like...
It's true, actually. Hiring people is the most expensive part of business.
Yeah.
And so if you're constantly, having to hire and train
right.
and retrain,
yeah.
then that's, like you said, economically inefficient. So
right.
not only is this best for workers, it's actually best for businesses.
Absolutely. Also, kind of side note, sort of, but paid sick days are also great for working parents.
Yes.
Because,
you get sick so much.
Right. You get sick a ton, but also what if your kid's really sick?
Right.
And I'm not...
And you need to take care of them.
Right. I mean, I think there should be separate, like family leave, and that's something different, but let's just work with what we have here. Paid sick days, so if your kid is really sick... And they can't go to school or they can't go to where they usually go, being able to take a paid day off to take care of them
right.
is really
it's
important.
Necessary. Yeah.
And it really will, add to the, you know, affordable healthcare aspect affordable childcare aspect, sure, of being a parent, yeah, whether single or working or otherwise. It's really an issue.
Definitely. I will say in the family leave side, there, mm-hmm, are municipalities and states that are working on this. And I think, yes, San Francisco is one of the, at the forefront, of course.
Of course.
So definitely, I mean, local politics, it's sexy. And, yeah, this is a thing that people don't really talk about a lot, but,
right,
it's so important. It's so crucial. I love that you added that to your gratitude,
yes,
check.
So the second thing that I'm grateful for are the motherfucking Girl Scouts.
Yes. We talked about the Boy Scouts, right, earlier on. Devin, she's talked about being a Girl Scout.
Yes.
What specifically are you grateful for?
So, well, I'm always fucking grateful for the Girl Scouts. And actually, I'm still friends. I had a troop of eight, and we all went through all the way to the end of high school.
Oh.
I'm still friends with all seven of my troop mates.
You're not allowed to have any other childhood friends except me.
I know, right? You know, just like dump them.
Yeah.
But this week in particular, I'm grateful for them. So first, the Girl Scouts of America, or USA, rolled out 23 new STEM-focused merit badges.
Ooh.
If this sounds familiar, it's because a couple weeks ago I talked about, or maybe a couple months ago, the girl...
Time is a weird concept. Trump era.
The Girl Scouts announced 18 merit badges focused specifically on cybersecurity.
Right.
So this is different.
They're going to save us from
everything.
Election meddling.
Oh, 100%. It's going to be these girls who are learning how to code now.
Yeah.
So they are badassing just all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going to let this speak for itself. So, quote, Girl Scouts of America partnered with groups dedicated to encouraging young women to take part in STEM programs like the Society of Women Engineers, Code.org, and the Leave No Trace Center for Outdoor Ethics. The newest rollout of badges allows scouts to create algorithms, design robots and race cars, go on environmentally conscious camping trips, collect data in the great outdoors, try their hand at engineering, and so much more. Girls will learn to program, build problem-solving robots, and even learn about aviation design, opening them up to another world of education.
That sounds amazing.
I know.
I kind of want to go and be a Girl Scout.
I know. It's amazing. And even when I was a Girl Scout and they didn't have these sort of like STEM badges, because these really are that new.
Yeah.
I'm not that old.
Yeah.
But I mean, from Girl Scouts, I learned about economics, accounting, balancing my checkbook. Mm-hmm. Like, those are all things I learned from Girl Scouts.
Yeah. I was a Girl Scout in elementary school. And then, yeah, after I had to like sell a bunch of cookies, I was, yeah, like, I'd rather eat the cookies.
Yeah, right? Like, hard pass.
Yeah. I think part of it for me was I just really wanted to play soccer.
Right.
So I was like, that's where I'm going, right, to devote my free time. But I have fond memories of the Girl Scouts.
Yeah. And I would just like to remind everyone, especially on the heels of this announcement from Trump that he's banning transgender people from the military, that in 2015, the Girl Scouts of Western Washington returned a $100,000 donation.
Wow.
Because it came with the stipulation that they would not use it to, quote, support transgender girls.
Holy shit.
So they literally said, thanks, but no thanks, and sent the money back like the bad bitches that they are.
Yeah.
And then they raised $250,000 for their own.
Oh my God, checkmate, bitch.
Yeah, right? They like went on GoFundMe. They're like, well, we'd really love to like get this back. And people were like, yeah, take my money.
Take all my money.
Yeah. And so if you just kind of split screen this with Trump speaking in front of a crowd of Boy Scouts and, yeah, chanting USA while Trump degrades Obama, the media, and like says the word sex a whole bunch.
Oh, yeah. During that speech. Yeah,
it was weird. I said on Twitter, and I'll say it again, you know what the Girl Scouts would be chanting? Nothing.
Mm.
Trump would never be allowed to speak at a Girl Scout event.
Fuck.
So, yeah, yeah.
Although, didn't they participate in the inauguration in,
yeah,
some way? I'm not saying, not putting a damper. Like, they're not, like, perfect.
No.
That's okay. But, well, like, yeah, I don't think that they would let him speak at a rally.
They would not. And also, the Girl Scouts of America always extends an invitation to the First Lady to be an honorary...
Girl Scouter?
Yeah, like an honorary like board member
of
the Girl Scout leadership.
Interesting.
And that's just tradition. They've been doing it since its inception.
So, fun fact, when I worked for Major League Soccer in New York, the Girl Scouts headquarters was in the same building.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
there was always a lot of Girl Scout cookies.
Oh, 100%. So they're not perfect,
yeah,
but I just, from what I don't know from the Girl Scouts, they would never allow Trump anywhere near a Girl Scout event.
Yeah.
So.
For sure.
So, Sarah, what are you grateful for?
So the first thing I'm grateful for is the South Carolina Supreme Court. And this story was sent to me by one of our listeners, also a Sarah.
Taking over the world.
Partial to Sarah's, yeah. So the state's highest court ruled on Wednesday that people in same-sex relationships in South Carolina should get the same legal protections against domestic violence as heterosexual couples, which is so important.
It's also, I can't believe that this has to be, we have to say this, that has to be a rule.
Yep, I mean, court. The courts are, you know, a big part of our public policy.
Yeah, they really are.
They really are.
It's a bedrock of democracy, an independent judiciary.
As we're certainly learning in the Trump era.
Yeah, right.
So the ruling also deemed a portion of the state's domestic violence law unconstitutional. So the current law defines household members as a spouse, former spouse, people with a child in common, or men and women who are or have lived together. So it does not include unmarried same-sex couples.
Right.
So the acting justice who wrote the majority opinion said during oral arguments in March 2016 that he felt the law was, quote, pretty clearly unconstitutional in its discriminatory impact upon same-sex couples. The court then wrote, in this case, we cannot find a reasonable basis for providing protection to one set of domestic violence victims while denying it to others. Other states have addressed this issue since the U.S. Supreme Court's 2015 decision legalizing gay marriage nationwide. The Ohio Supreme Court in 2016 adopted the use of gender-neutral references in family court cases. And then California and Massachusetts, again, California, shout out to California, but California and Massachusetts proactively change language in their laws.
Yeah, that's great. I think gender-neutral pronouns is so important.
Yeah.
Which I've never understood, just aside, like, left turn, but marriage is a contract, and contracts don't really include gender. Like, that's not really how they work.
Yeah, we could go down a whole
rabbit hole
route. But yeah, so some states like Ohio adopted gender-neutral references, and then California and Massachusetts proactively changed language in their law. So there's a few different ways people can go about that. So Bakari Sellers, who is a former legislator and also an attorney for the woman who brought the case forward, said that the case was an opportunity to push South Carolina forward. He said, quote, "We all know that South Carolina is usually a few decades behind the rest of the union, but that it takes good people of all walks of life to set aside prejudice and preconceived notions. Today, love one."
That's beautiful.
Yeah. So, you know, these are the kind of things that stories that fly below the radar have such a huge impact on people's lives and are so important. So thank you to Sarah for flagging this story for me.
Local politics is sexy.
Local politics.
You elect judges in your district.
Yeah. I don't know about Supreme Court, state Supreme Court.
I don't
judges,
know about that. But
yeah, local judgeships.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So all of this matters. So South Carolina Supreme Court, that's my first gratitude check. And then my second gratitude check is New Hampshire Democrats.
No.
So Democratic Manchester Ward 1 Alderman Kevin Kavanaugh upset Republican former Senator David Booten in a special state Senate election on Tuesday. So he won 55% to 44%.
Wow.
Yeah, nearly 8,700 votes were cast, making for a turnout of nearly 21%, which is impressive for a midsummer special election.
It really is.
I mean, ideally we get, you know, our voter participations up everywhere, but for a special election in the midsummer, this is apparently pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So this election was necessitated by the death of Democratic Senator Scott McGillivray in March, who was the first Democrat to win the seat in more than three decades.
Wow.
So it had been held by Republicans for more than three decades. He flipped it, but then he died.
Right.
So Kavanaugh's win kept the seat in Democratic hands and also kept the Republican majority in the Senate at just 14 to 10.
That's great.
Yeah, so the win was viewed as an upset because registration figures show 35% of the district's voters are Republicans, 29% are Democrats, and undeclared voters are the largest segment at 36%, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, Booten had held this seat from 2010 through 2016 and was better known district-wide than Kavanaugh. So this is like really quite a shock, quite a surprise, especially that he won by 11 points.
Right.
And, you know, as we know, New Hampshire isn't the only place where Democrats are notching local wins. And we've talked about this on our podcast before. A few weeks ago, Democrats flipped two seats in the Oklahoma state legislature in districts Trump won in 2016. And in 21 of the 28 special elections held since November, including those congressional races, Democratic candidates have outperformed Hillary Clinton's 2016 election margins by an average of 12 points. And they have won 13 races and flipped four.
Yeah, this is, margins matter.
Margins matter.
It's really important, mm-hmm. even if you don't win.
Yep. Yeah, so right now, national polls are showing Democrats with a double-digit lead on the generic ballot, which is a term that pollsters use to ask voters which party they'd like to see win the House of Representatives. And just for reference, before Democrats swept the House in 2006 and 2008, Democrats had a 9-point lead on Republicans.
Wow.
So, you know, a lot could happen between now and 2018. We've talked about voter suppression.
Yes.
A lot. We've talked with Sarah Kendzior. You know, there's a big fear that 2018, the elections aren't going to be free or fair. I mean, right. they already haven't been super free
right.
or fair because of rampant voter suppression. So,
like Stacey Abrams talked about.
But the president's party usually suffers big losses in the midterms. Yeah. They've lost 33 seats on average in the majority of midterms since the Civil War. So it feels like there's a wave coming.
Yes.
I mean, a lot can happen. You know, we have to keep up our momentum. But these are good signs. And so I'm grateful for these, like, flips in local elections.
Absolutely. So let's get into some listener gratitude checks.
Yes.
Because I think it's a segment that I really like.
We love it.
So first is from a listener, Beth. She said, quote, "My husband made it through major surgery to remove his tumor. And we're so glad to hear that. And this one feels really especially relevant given the current healthcare debate hot mess happening right now."
Yes.
So Beth, we're so happy to hear that.
That's a great gratitude check.
It is.
Kenya said, "Girls Trip," the movie, is her gratitude check. She said, "Deep belly laughs and a night out is bomb for the soul."
Yeah.
I want to see that movie so bad.
Me too. It looks so good.
It looks so good. I've heard really good things.
Yeah. So Heatha? Mm-hmm. Heatha said, "Your podcast, Women Senators, Nancy Pelosi," hard agree, "and Brazilian cheese bread," also hard agree.
I actually started Googling Brazilian cheese bread and I got into a little Brazilian cheese bread hole.
Yep.
I was like, that sounds like everything I want.
Yes, absolutely.
Bread and cheese?
Yeah,
yes,
it's
please.
Perfect.
And then my mom, I have to give a shout out to hashtag Laura because she also responded to our tweet. Of course she did. She said Santana, who's the family cat. And Jen, who's my sister, and then she said, "And twinsies," so that's like what me and Jen call each other. And then she said, "And your visit," so I recently went there. And then she said, "And that Devin loves my Bitmoji mug." And just like for context, my mom tweeted this with a Bitmoji of her holding a bunch of cats that said "Happy Catter Day."
I love hashtag Laura so much.
She's so great.
So great.
I'm just grateful. I'm grateful for my mom, and I love how kooky and fun she is. All right, Devin. Well, it is Thursday.
Yes.
And we get to one of our favorite segments, which is the Maxine Waters update and the Maxine Waters Award in Badassery. So first of all, what has Queen Maxine been up to this week?
Well, Queen Maxine gave a fire interview with the New York Times magazine.
With the New York Times.
Yes. Yeah, they're like magazine section.
Oh, it's the magazine. And it was with actually Anna Marie Cox.
Yes.
With Friends Like These.
Right. So there are so many amazing things going on in this interview. But I do want to just say my little favorite tidbit that has nothing to do with anything. She collects black dolls.
Yeah, I had no idea
she collected
dolls.
She has more than 300 of them.
I know. I like kind of want to like see like what her house looks like.
I know. And she said that she thinks it stems from like the lack of representation she felt as a kid. So she collects them. And I thought that was just really adorable.
Yeah.
So she was talking about her thoughts on millennials.
I love how she calls us the millennials.
The millennials.
Like you have to add the. Yeah.
It's so good. She said, quote, "I like the way that they like the way that I don't camouflage how I feel. They don't see elected officials act that way." And she also points out that she hates the nickname Kerosene Maxine.
Yeah, I think like conservatives have
given her that.
Given her that, which is bullshit.
Yeah, and she prefers Auntie Maxine if you're going to call her anything.
Yeah. Also, this quote is just delightful. She said, "I have been adopted by the millennials and I'm enjoying every minute of it. I'm learning a new language. You never think about shade, for example, other than, you know, a tree is providing shade. But when they taught me what shade was, I thought, now, isn't that creative?"
Yeah. She's so amazing.
That was like the cutest thing I've ever read.
I know.
It's so great.
So she also talks about black voters voting Democratic because they feel it's in their best interest, though she does want the Democratic Party to focus on issues that directly affect the black community, such as opportunities for all people and then police violence.
And we talked about that a little bit with Stacey Abrams.
Yes.
It's like speaking to your constituents and not running
and
away
community.
from the issues that have defined Democrats.
Yes. And she also discusses how she is often dismissed for being successful because she's a black woman.
Yep.
And people think that she has no right to do well for herself. And she was responding to something that Tucker Carlson said.
Yeah.
Basically like asking her like why she has a nice house.
Which is so racially coded.
Oh, it's disgusting.
And like I feel like people have done that too with Obama.
Yes.
When people were up in arms over his speech money. It's like every single white male president has gotten speech money. Why are all of a sudden are you upset that a black man is
exactly.
getting money? Like, I do think there's a lot of racism embedded with that. And for people who try to claim otherwise, that's fucking bullshit.
Yeah. Also, this interview closes on the following note. Quote, "If you could have a private conversation with Trump, what would you say to him?" Queen Maxine responds, "I would not waste my time."
Yes.
Mic drop.
It just She's everything. And also proving that you can, in fact, walk and chew gum at the same time and text your bestie.
Yeah. Like, you can do more than two.
I mean, Stacey Abrams has shown us that you can do a bajillion things right at once. I mean, come on. Get on Stacey Abrams and Maxine Waters level. So Maxine, Nancy Pelosi, and Elizabeth Warren spoke out against the repeal of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's ripoff clause.
Yeah.
And so they were really forceful in that, while also talking about healthcare, while also talking about... Certainly, Maxine talks about Russia. Which, speaking of, she also called for a bipartisan investigation into Trump's financial ties to Russia, which we know, you know, Mueller's probe has expanded to address that.
And she just keeps beating that drum, and I love it.
Mm-hmm. She went on Joy Reid and said about Attorney General Jeff Sessions, quote, "I can't imagine anyone who has any self-respect being talked about like that and wanting to remain in the job." And she's referring to Trump sort of trash talking Jeff Sessions and like humiliating him at every opportunity and saying like how disappointed he is in him as Attorney General, how he might not have hired him. And like we said, Jeff Sessions is holding on to Attorney General with like his cold dead hands.
Oh, 100%. And then today, Maxine showed a photo of Trump mocking a disabled reporter as she marks the anniversary of the landmark Disabilities Act.
Yeah, so you know in like congressional like hearings or whatever, you can have like these big exhibits. She blew up that photo of Trump mocking that reporter to really, like Devin said, mark this anniversary of a landmark Disabilities Act. So she's got her hand in a bunch of different places. She's doing all kinds of great work.
Yes.
So we bow down to you, Queen Maxine.
We do.
Okay, so Devin, let's get into our Maxine Waters Award in Badassery, and we have a few honorable mentions.
We do.
So speaking of that landmark Disabilities Act, who was our first honorable mention?
So the disability rights activists of ADAPT. So they have vowed an indefinite sit-in if the ACA is successfully repealed.
Yeah.
So this comes after this was a protest before the motion to proceed was passed.
Yeah.
But they avowed that they would...
occupy the Hart building.
Yes, occupy the Hart building indefinitely or until police arrest them one by one.
Yeah.
So they tweeted, quote, "We'd rather go to jail than die without Medicaid. Adapt and resist." So after the Senate passed the MTP, the police circled protesters in the atrium of the Hart building. And an organizer told Mike that at least 25 protesters have been arrested so far.
Wow.
So, and one reporter noted that there was a blood trail coming from a man that the police were dragging away. So
these ADAPT protesters, honestly, I think are the real MVPs of this healthcare
100%.
Protest and resistance, because they have been doing such amazing, crucial work. And they've organized so effectively. You know, this is not the first time we've talked about them on the show. It's not the first time ADAPT protesters have come out to fight for the ACA. In a press release for a protest last month, ADAPT said, quote, "The bill caps and significantly cuts Medicaid, which will greatly reduce access to medical care for elderly and disabled Americans who will either die or be forced into institutions. Our lives and liberty shouldn't be stolen to give a tax break to the wealthy." I mean, this is not hyperbole. This is life or death. This is their livelihoods.
Right.
And I'm so in awe of them, and I'm so inspired by them, and they are the real MVPs of this resistance against the Trump administration, the Republicans trying to take away healthcare.
Absolutely. So next we have Senators Murkowski and Collins.
Yes.
So we talked about them before briefly. The Senate voted on the motion to proceed on healthcare, and Murkowski from Alaska and Collins from Maine were the only two GOP senators to vote no on the motion.
Yeah, I would just like to point out that 2 of 5 Republican women voted no. 47 Republican men voted yes.
Yes.
So don't ever tell me that gender parity in politics doesn't matter.
Absolutely.
It fucking matters.
It does. Because even though they peeled off 2 Republicans, that's still 50-50, and Mike motherfucking literal Pence broke the tie and moved the bill forward. Mm-hmm. So, look, the absolute spinelessness of the GOP is nothing new, especially during this administration, but this is a new low even for them. And while several Republican senators have spoken out against the bill, only 2 followed through.
And they were women.
And I really thought we had Capito, too.
Yeah.
You know, a little disappointing. But lest we forget... Murkowski and Collins, both women, are also the only two who voted against DeVos's confirmation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that was the other tie Mike motherfucking literal Pence had to break.
He's breaking all kinds of ties.
Yeah. And so now Trump is coming after these two women, saying that their votes were, quote, very sad for them. Whatever that fucking means. I don't know. And Murkowski's feathers aren't ruffled by this little temper tantrum. Speaking to reporters, she said, quote, we're here to govern.
Yeah, she's like, listen, bitch, this is, I care about my constituents, like, and she's like, I don't even really go on Twitter, like,
yeah,
he can tweet his little heart away, basically.
I don't know
she
her.
Basically told him in sort of coded language, I would like to think, to fuck off.
To go fuck off, like, I don't know her.
Yeah, and also, apparently, I read from the Alaska newspaper that the Interior Secretary is trying to intimidate both senators from Alaska, saying that they're, you know, especially Murkowski, their votes on, you know, legislative items, especially healthcare, could negatively impact other things in terms of, you know, government assistance to Alaska. And which I would say that the Interior Secretary was short-sighted in this.
Oh, yes.
Because she apparently controls a lot of the appropriations for the Interior Secretary.
She does.
And in like an ultimate power move, apparently delayed some of like the nominations or the processes for appointing people.
That's such a beautiful middle finger.
I know.
And I aspire to be that.
It's basically a try me, bitch.
Oh, right. She also stared down near political death in 2010 and won.
Yeah.
She was primaried by a Tea Partier, ran in the general anyway, and won by writing campaign, and Murkowski is not easy to spell.
Yeah.
So...
So she's like, this is nothing.
Like, relax. Like,
yeah, she's like, try me.
Yeah.
Nope.
And, you know, the two of them having the courage to stand up to Trump and McConnell and every other mediocre white dude trying to disguise tax cuts for the rich as healthcare reform is a glimmer of hope in this dumpster fire.
Yeah.
And I really feel that Murkowski and Collins are what Republicans should be. You know, you can be moderate. You can have different ideas. But, like... follow through. Have a spine. Like,
Some integrity.
Have some integrity. Protect your constituents.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And like, you know, we probably don't agree with them in a lot of other things.
Not
but in
at
this
all.
Specific instance, we give them a round of applause for sure. And I also, I think I want to give an honorable mention to Senator Mazie Hirono. As we mentioned before, she was diagnosed with stage 4 kidney cancer 3 weeks ago. And she voted against the motion to proceed on Tuesday. But she was not given a round of applause like John McCain. So we at Hellbent would like to recognize her efforts because
100%.
She is actually, you know, someone who is experiencing a hardship, a health hardship, and is following through and having compassion for other people. She's also a Democrat. So
yeah.
But still, you know, I think, you know, she told NPR last week that her diagnosis shows, quote, why it is so true that all of us are just one diagnosis away from a major illness. She also said, quote, I was able to sit down with my doctor and decide how I was going to fight my cancer, not how I was going to pay for it. No one should have to worry about whether they can afford the healthcare that one day might save their life.
Yeah.
So shout out to Senator Mazie Hirono. I think you're also an MVP.
She is an MVP. And then our winner for this week is Navy SEAL veteran Kristen Beck.
Yeah.
So Beck spent 20 years in the Navy and came out as transgender in 2013. After Trump's bizarre tweets that were supposed to, I guess, ban transgender service members from military service due to associated healthcare costs, which is
bullshit.
Just so meta at this moment.
Because of all the healthcare
stuff.
And also it's bullshit.
It's also just bullshit, but I just mean like it's all...
healthcare is happy. Yeah.
Yeah. And Beck said, quote, that's a cop-out. It is something else because the money was really not that much.
Yep.
Medical costs for transgender people are the equivalent of one price of one wheel of a fighter. It's a leadership problem. Take care of your people.
100%.
Yeah.
And then Representative Sean Patrick Maloney, I thought, framed it really nicely.
Mm-hmm.
He said, quote, anyone who doubts the lethality of our trans service members should say that to Kristen Beck's face. She's a transgender member of SEAL Team 6, a veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan, and a Bronze Star and Purple Heart recipient. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think we should just respect her just because of these, you know, impressive physical accomplishments.
Right.
But because she's a person.
Right.
Like, even Orrin Hatch is like,
whoa.
They are people.
Right.
Like, he literally said, they are people.
Right. And she served her country bravely for 20 years. And her being transgender doesn't change that.
And we didn't talk about this before, but Trump dodged the draft.
Yes.
You know, and a lot of people pointed out just being trans in such a hateful world.
Right.
shows more courage than Donald Trump will ever have.
Absolutely.
So, yes. You know, I love also what she had a very optimistic quote.
And I love.
She said, quote, "We have a huge community and Trump just empowered the community. He gave the community one flag to join under. One tweet changed the elections in 2018. It changed the presidential race in 2020. We're going to rise up and change the landscape of America."
Yeah.
So I love that.
Really beautiful.
Yeah. So we, the Maxine Waters Award in Badassery goes to Navy SEAL veteran Kristen Beck.
Okay, Sarah, so last but not least, let's talk about some action items that our Hellions can do after they're done listening to the pod. So what do you have for us?
Well, first we have one from Stacey Abrams.
Okay, so as our listeners know, we like to do action items and give our listeners something to do after they listen to the show. So we have Representative Stacey Abrams here. And so, Representative Abrams, we would like to ask you, what is something that our listeners can do to, you know, fight, add to the resistance?
What's something on your radar that you want to direct our listeners to?
So voter suppression is a looming threat, and it's been in place for quite some time. Georgia was one of the first states to do voter ID. In 2014, I founded an organization called the New Georgia Project. They're working hard with other organizations across the state. A lot of those organizations focus on defending people of color and poor people from voter suppression. So I would encourage folks to go to newgeorgiaproject.org, learn about what's happening in Georgia, and then go look and find out what's happening in your state. But we've got to fight voter suppression on the ground every day.
Yeah, we actually, and I love that you have the New Georgia Project because y'all have done such great work. One resource that we like to point our listeners to is ourstates.org,
right?
So they can actually track in your state. Because, like you said, it's the state level that's going to make a difference, especially with voter suppression.
So call your local reps, newgeorgiaproject.org and ourstates.org are both great resources.
Okay, so that was a great action item from Stacey. Voter suppression is so, so crucial and important to democracy. Our first action item is to donate to Snopes.com. So they're the original warriors against fake news. They have a GoFundMe at GoFundMe.com/SaveSnopes. And I guess they're in this sort of like legal battle with their vendor who won't relinquish control of the site's hosting. So they can't modify the site, develop it, or most crucially, place advertising on it. And I guess the vendor continues to insert their own ads and has been withholding the advertising revenue from them.
Right.
So I would say if, you know, correcting fake news is important to you, Snopes is a great place to send your money to.
Absolutely. I think people also underestimate how expensive it is to keep a website like that running.
Yeah.
So
especially in this day and age, there's so many lies.
Exactly. And it really does take quite a bit of money just to keep it going month to month.
Yep.
So it's just something to remember. Also, so the next one is kind of about the Trump's tweets about transgender service members. So if you're pissed about this ban,
which we're assuming you are,
There's a really great Medium post by at Call Me They that you should read. And basically, the too long didn't read was, be careful with your language and how you frame your outrage. So from this piece, quote, "The more people that take up this work to be better, the more people that truly support trans equality and justice equals the less transphobia, trans antagonism, and anti-trans laws and policy that will come into our world until they are squashed for good."
Yeah, so this article gives a lot of different ways that you yourself can be better. So take in media by trans creators, be aware of subtle transphobic language and jokes and call them out when you hear them or see them, educate yourself about violence against the trans community here and abroad, use your cis privilege actively to combat transphobia, and then I would also add, pay trans people.
Yes.
PayPals, Patreons, CashMe's, etc. Support their work. I mean, this is a good time more than ever to support the trans community.
Absolutely. And one really powerful quote that I liked from this piece was, quote, "You likely won't get Trump to stop being terrible, but you can look in the mirror and be better. Work hard at this. We can all be better."
Yep. And then on a related note, donate to Lambda Legal while you're at it. Mm-hmm. So they are the oldest and largest national legal organization whose mission is to achieve full recognition of the civil rights of LGBT people and those with HIV through impact litigation, education, and public policy work. They vowed to file a lawsuit immediately if Trump's tweets turn into policy. So you can go to lambdalegal.org/donate.
And just on a personal note, I donate regularly to mm-hmm. Lambda Legal because I think they do great work. And they just sent me a sweet rainbow wristband that my Ooh. Son is obsessed with. So I'll put a picture
just
on Twitter.
Just if you need another reason.
Just in case you need one more reason.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I don't know. I thought that was really cute.
Yeah,
so.
Totally cute. And then, of course, the last thing, we're going to harp on healthcare again. Clearly, here in the Upside Down, we're in a world in which we are in the peril of losing healthcare for millions of people. And we don't even know what the fuck they're voting on any given hour of any given day.
We have no idea. So get angry and call your senators. Like, get pissed.
But if you do have Democratic senators, I would say call them and thank them for yes. their position, but also tell them to do everything they can.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, just depending on how much of a dickwad your senator is.
Exactly.
Is like, what your tone should be.
You can finagle it. Yeah. So there's an amazing sort of choose-your-own-adventure style thread by the Indivisible Group.
Yes.
That I thought was, first of all, just really cool use of Twitter.
Yeah.
And so that gives you options like click here if you're in a red state or click here if you're in a blue state. And it takes you to another thread with information on how to either, if you're in a blue state, urge your senators to bring up a point of order to challenge amendments that don't comply with the board rule. And if you choose red state, they tell you to, call your senator and say that any version of this bill would be devastating and that they should vote against final passage.
Yeah. And if you're in a blue state, it can feel like there isn't as much you can do to affect the outcome of the bill, but do not sit on the sidelines. There's still a lot you can do. As Indivisible stated in their epic choose your own adventure style thread,
yeah.
you can urge your senators to bring up points of order, or as Executive Director Ezra Levin urges, join a phone bank to save ACA. And you can also urge your friends in red states to call their senators too. And we're going to have all these links in our show notes.
Yes, absolutely.
Also, the Women's March alerted me to this. If you go to ourlivesareontheline.org/ #find, you can find an event in your area on Saturday to protest the GOP efforts to take away healthcare.
Yeah.
So that's another way you can show your support.
Right. And then lastly, I just want to say, don't despair. It's okay to get fatigued sometimes, and I get it. Sarah gets it. Mm-hmm. We all get it. Take care of yourself. Let yourself take a breath and trust your community to keep going, and then jump back in so someone else can take a breath. We can do it, but only if we do it together.
Yep.
And remember, a very smart woman once said that we are stronger together, and I still believe it.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, that was a really packed show, as it always is.
Yes.
I mean, that's like an evergreen tweet.
It's a perma tweet.
Perma tweet. Perma phrase.
Perma phrase.
Hellbent. We love getting to talk to Stacey Abrams.
I
think you're going to love the interview.
Yes.
And if you're a Patreon contributor, we will have a bonus podcast up for you before the weekend. So look out for that.
And if not, we will see you back here on Monday. Have a good weekend, Hellions. For more information on today's episode, please visit our website at www.hellbentpodcast.com. You'll find the articles we discussed as well as additional resources. You can follow us on Twitter at HellbentPod, and you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/HellbentPodcast. You can follow Devin on Twitter at DevinHandy, and you can follow Sarah on Twitter at SarahLerner.
Please listen on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because that's just like the rules of feminism. We also have a Patreon, and you can find us at patreon.com/hellbentpodcast. You can support us for as little as $1 a month, and for $5 a month, you get access to exclusive content, mini podcasts, and behind-the-scenes looks at the making of Hellbent. And there are lots of other fun rewards for higher levels of patronage, including a monthly Skype session with Devin and Sarah.
And for that one, drinking is optional.
Optional.
Quote unquote.
Quote.